Now, the shotgun start in golf is full of mathematics. There's a lot of setup work that we have to do in order to make a tournament work. So I'm going to demonstrate to you just exactly how we do a shotgun start here.
And here we go.
All right, all right, all right. Gentlemen, start your
greetings and welcome to a Wednesday edition of the Shotgun Start. It is May 27th. Andy, how we doing?
Brendan, I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm good. Fantastic. Beautiful, beautiful day. Weather talk here. More weather small talk. Quarantine small talk. Beautiful day here. You know, touched 80. It just makes you a little extra peppy until we get into full-on sweat season in Maryland, which is like just a sauna built on a swamp. But so we're in a nice little like middle trial period, and my vow to not turn the air conditioning on, very like dad shit type stuff, I refuse to turn on the AC before we get to June this year, and I think we're gonna make it. You know, it's just against principle to turn it on, and often we can't make it around here. But
lucky you.
So I think we're getting there. This week could get dicey. We might touch 90. But that's the big drama of the week.
We were at 87 yesterday.
Did you turn on the air?
Yeah.
Do you have air?
Yeah.
You did.
We got air. Yeah.
Soft little millennial over there. Turn on the air.
You know what? Kidding. See, one of our issues, our house, our second floor. It's a really old house. Our second floor. It doesn't get cold in the AC like doesn't work in the winter. Or in the summer, yeah. And then in the winter, the heat doesn't work up there at all. It's like freezing cold up there, or it's really hot, and it's just like, it just sucks.
I've had this issue as well. We don't need to get into home HVAC issues right now, but what else? How are you doing? Are you good? Everything
I'm
fine?
I'm doing okay. I got after it a little bit yesterday, so today been shaking off some cobwebs.
You know, we exchanged texts yesterday, probably about 5-6 o'clock. And at that point, I thought the likelihood of Ernie L's part two happening on Wednesday was in doubt, in peril. And sure enough, we will not be doing that tonight. You know, I was like, man, like holiday Monday after show done, like that rivals like the Thursday night feeling after finishing for the week. And we were both on our way, and worse for the wear, Tuesday to start the week. You know, when you don't have the podcast, you get that extra day. We took full advantage. So there will be no Ernie. We're going to do a flashlight on a fun character, maybe two flashlights, and do a little talking about the news here.
Yeah.
So what should we start with?
Ernie's going to be Friday.
Allegedly.
Ernie will be Friday.
And have no fear. I mean, these are all going to be stitched together in the end in some larger project, right? We're not going to have part one, part two, talking about random news. It'll be presented in a larger library at some point down the line.
When all of you want to re-listen to 2 hours on Ernie L's.
Sandy Lyle and whoever else. Okay, news. The match is the largest rating for a cable golf event in history. So cable limits it somewhat, you know, I guess that, what is that? Golf Channel, the TNT first couple rounds.
Masters, ESPN.
That doesn't count. Oh, what? ESPN part. Yeah, I gotcha. First couple rounds. Yeah.
Early rounds of majors. It's pretty impressive.
So what was it? 5.8, you said?
5.8.
6.3, I think, at one point. I'm not a ratings person. I think this is often... I don't even know what it means. Does it imbue any kind of, you know, I don't know, value on a thing, whether it was good or bad? It's just it was popular at the time. That doesn't mean something was worthwhile. But
it was better than the Last Dance.
Was it?
Mm-hmm. That was average 5.6.
Good. So, yeah, not to say this wasn't worthwhile. I'm just saying ratings sometimes are just this Twitter nonsense we chase. But... it was massively popular. What do you attribute this? And do you think anything should be taken, you know, should we take some sort of learning or extrapolate this in a way going forward?
I think that it's very easy to understand why it did well. You had probably the two most recognizable golfers, and then you had two of the greatest quarterbacks of all time playing with them. So you,
beyond the two most recognizable golfers, like the most recognizable golfer of all time, like the biggest television draw of all time, not just, you know, the most recognizable of an era, but a phenomenon, a Michael Jordan type draw.
So you pulled from numerous cross sections, you know, yes. And then also obviously with the pandemic going on, you had no competition. You were up against nothing, which is a huge part of it.
I think there was a curiosity that came into it. I think the peak came like really when the word had really spread on Tom Brady kind of
being terrible.
Tripping over himself. Yeah. So like there was a curiosity that touched a lot of buckets that probably won't come back for golf, but that's fine. You know, whatever. Well, they got exposure here.
Here's the thing. It's like Bill Simmons and Ryan Russillo led their show talking about golf for 40 minutes.
Well, that's because there were no other sports.
Yeah. But at the same time, they were talking about how they enjoyed watching it.
Okay.
And they aren't golf fans. They're not golfers. Like, that's the thing that this thing did was that it made golf approachable.
Maybe.
A usually unapproachable sport. Not unapproachable, but difficult to approach sport. It made very approachable, easy to get into, and easy to follow.
Okay. So there was a curiosity about it. I think the ratings are great. I thought the broadcast is great. I thought it was presented well. Whether that means like the ratings are justification for the ratings were high because of who was involved in the time in which this sportsless time it was, you know, proceeding. So I think to reason that the rating were because of the way it was covered or the broadcast or that they were mic'd up is really sort of like a fool's errand. Like, and I saw a little bit of that happening. Colin Cowherd, you know, kind of whatever. We've cited now Bill Simmons, Ryan Russell, and Colin Cowherd in the last 90 seconds. But like, I think to say the rating was because of the way it was broadcast is kind of is precarious, especially going forward. Thinking that you'll get big ratings all of a sudden because you have mic'd up players. That doesn't mean you shouldn't have mic'd up players, but I think I saw a lot of justification for the ratings being, you know, using the broadcast for it.
I will say if you promote a better broadcast, you will get better ratings.
What does that mean?
If you have a better product, you will get better ratings.
That's true. So what's replicable though?
I think the mic'd up players is replicable. Yeah. I think the format of hey, we're going to put people and we're going to play matches. People understand matches. People understand it's really easy and it's something easy to follow. I'm going to watch this guy play this guy and it's interesting because then you pick a guy and you root for him, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Like, that's the thing that golf lacks is who's your favorite golf? Everybody asks me, who's your favorite golfer? And I'm like, you know, I don't know. I really don't have one. Why don't you have one? Well, I don't really care. But if you ask me any other sport, what's your favorite team? It's immediate. I know what it is because they play against other teams and I have to root for them. With a golf tournament, they're playing against 144 guys. Like, you don't necessarily root for golfers. You're just watching a tournament, and you're very rarely rooting for it because it's not a win-lose proposition most weeks for these guys.
I saw Charles Barkley today on Dan Patrick's show exhorting the PGA Tour to mic up the players, especially if they're coming back with no fans. So that seems like a good idea in theory. I think people, you know, we've been calling for mic'd up players forever.
It's never going to happen because the players won't let it happen.
And the players run the organization. They run the league. Why don't you think they'll let it happen if they
remember
care about their product and popularity?
Remember what happened with the John Rahm thing last year?
That Sawgrass?
Yeah. Like, just take that as one example. Like, I don't know what we could do more. I'm convinced that somehow out of this whole thing, the PGA Tour is going to take one aspect of the match and think this is what we need to do, and then turn it into the worst thing they could possibly, like, just ruin it. This is just the cynical side of me.
What, the mic'd up thing?
Just like one aspect of the match, they're gonna take, like, you know, some one club challenge, and they're gonna make it just miserable. They're gonna beat it to death and kill it. You know,
the Wyndham Rewards lawn drive hole type thing.
Yeah,
if you have the longest drive, you get an extra mint on your pillow, kind of thing.
They're somehow gonna be like, we learned this from this, and then they're gonna turn it into something terrible.
Do you think mic'd up players?
I think
even.
Do you think
that's
going to
give
player.
Us a lot of value in the way it did the other day? Is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So the other day you had JT there, kind of like instigating more discussion, explaining the shots. You think A, we would get a lot of player caddy combos that would get cut into the broadcast. That's the thing. Can the coverage keep up with it? Can they cut it in? You know, it's going to have to be censored no matter what. So, like, but there's going to be a delay and all that. But
I mean, that's one of the big challenges of golf, right? Is like, how do you cover if there's 20 guys within three shots of the lead on Sunday? Like, how do you possibly have people that are able to follow all those conversations? I think one thing that jumped to my mind when you were just saying that was like, it would be pretty awesome for PGA Tour Live.
Yeah.
Where maybe that's where it starts, where you mic up players for PGA Tour Live, and that early round coverage all of a sudden has a little bit more juice to it. And the announcers there have to carry so much of the broadcast. Like, you know, if...
And again, we said the other day, they're very... I mean, they have that much more experience, but they're also just kind of watching a screen like we are at home and trying to guess on some of the stuff based on their knowledge and experience, which is much more vast than the average viewer. But
the other thing with PGA Tour Live, watching PGA Tour Live is essentially watching an event without fans. Like Thursday morning Heritage does not, it's not like there's a raucous environment there.
Yeah.
Like, so like when Barkley says like, you can't have golf come back without fans. It's like, well, do you ever watch golf on Thursday and Friday? Because it's kind of what it is.
All right, so that's going to make a better product. If in a dream world, it would make a better product, and that would make...
I think PGA Tour
popular,
Live would be higher, like... I kind of like watching... I like watching PGA Tour Live almost more than I like watching like Saturday, Sunday coverage.
Wow, they'll be ecstatic to hear that at Pontevedra HQ, their streaming product. Very popular in the egg household.
Well, I love watching guys play full rounds because I think you lose that with the way that coverage jumps around. But like watching a guy play a full round, you really learn a lot. Like you don't have to be perfect. And there are a lot of little things that happen that are why, you know, especially back in the day when Spieth didn't stink, like how he could turn around into 66. And you're like, God, he shouldn't have shot anything below 72, but you watch and there's interest, there's about how these guys can plot along, and all of a sudden if they added mic'd players, PGA Tour Live would be an excellent product.
So here's my main point with that.
You wouldn't
too,
even announce like, you wouldn't need announcers.
Maybe. Here's my main point about that I think mic'd up players is an advancement that also caters to the core audience and the core product, right? And ideally makes your product better. So much of this stuff that they're trying to improve their product or spice up the broadcast, A, turns off your core group, which is a very wealthy kind of, not that that matter, but like your audience is like a very highly valuable diehard type audience. And they think, well, I guess they think you'll come back no matter what, whatever kind of fluff. And, you know, here's Nick Faldo lifting weights, or here's the FedEx Cup, you know, cartoon. Like, I guess they think you'll come back no matter what. But this would be a thing that, A, kind of enriches the experience for those people, and B, you know, improves the core product to, you know, create a curiosity for the outsider bucket that they're always looking to chase. That's my whole thing with this. With always our complaints about the tour is like, they get so far afield from like who their real audience is and who their product is, they risk turning off like what could make it good and what makes their audience valuable. So, and I think live mics doesn't turn off anybody, you know, it doesn't turn anyone away. All right. Anything else on the ratings? Care about that? Or
I mean, it says something. It says this is a product. You know, there's obvious things that worked in its advantage, hugely in its advantage, to its advantage. But if this was a normal sports Sunday, I'm confident that that still would have outrated a typical PGA Tour Sunday. And that says something.
Sure.
If this format with four golfers, two of whom suck, is a better product, is a more popular product than your core product, that's not a good thing. It's not a good thing at all.
It's a good point. And I think if they're doing it every week or three times a month, does it lose its kind of fizzles after?
No, I don't think so. Because if you have your best players playing, like your biggest stars playing, there's always going to be huge interest. I was texting with somebody who will remain nameless about how big of a problem load management is considered in the NBA, where, you know, these guys are playing 60 games of an 82 game season, and superstars are like, you know, people buy tickets and superstars don't play right in a game.
Yeah. Yep.
And the league is like so split and torn about load management, and they're addressing it's a huge problem. We need our star players playing every time they can, right? They want to have them play in every game. Okay, the PGA Tour is essentially like the opposite. It's like surprising when the star players play. They have so many events and it's so diluted.
Yeah.
You know, like they're it's so rare. Like we get so excited when it's Riviera week and we're like,
so
hey,
what are
you know
suggesting
what?
Though?
10 of the top 12 players are in the field.
Are you trying to? But you're suggesting we add more. You're suggesting we add Tuesday night.
But with star players, because it's so rare, we actually get to see star players play, and it's the reason there's no rivalries. They play the same week 10 weeks a year. So they play 10 events they all play in, okay, and then every other event it's like maybe you might have two of the top 10 guys. You might have, you know, sometimes we have events where you have one top 20 player. It's just a joke. There's too many events. The tour has diluted its product too much.
Do you think real rivalry can be kind of fostered and born in that setting?
Yes.
The goofy, silly season game.
If you
like
make it worse
Sunday.
Something. That's the thing I learned from the podcast we did with Stephen Proctor. Is like those challenge matches back in the day were 4 days. This is not what would happen now, but it was 4 days of 36 hole match play. And things would get chippier. It was like a playoff series.
Right.
And like by the final day, there's like bad blood between players. And you're not going to, these guys, the best players in the world are all extraordinarily competitive. Right. And if they're doing a season of match play thing of the best players in the world are in this thing, and like I'm Rory and I lose to Brooks 3 times in a row, I'm gonna be like trying really hard. Like you don't want to lose to the guy 4th time. Like
do you think the PGL is approximates this what you're
the PGL messed up by doing stroke play. I know they want the stroke play for the official world golf rankings, but where the chippiness would come is these matches.
Okay.
And I think that's where the greater appeal comes. It's so easy to understand. It's like, okay, he won that hole, he lost that hole. There's a win-loss every single hole. There's a match within the match, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's what's the compelling thing about match play. And if you had 4 matches on the golf course at once, you wouldn't have any dead time, too. It would be one of my favorite days of watching golf is, like, that round of, like,
quarters.
16 in the USAM. And they've got all those matches going on, and they just are they're going back and forth. From when I was a kid till, like, you know, and it's the same thing with singles on Sunday at the Ryder Cup. It's incredible. All of the Ryder Cups are incredible. And that's essentially what you could do. The problem is getting to the way you could do it where you wouldn't hurt the OWGR thing is if it was like a season-long thing with a select group of guys. And that's where the PGA Tour could own it and have a real product.
I think it's...
And it's another thing they could sell. That's the other thing.
Yeah. So why they're just committed to these old events, right? Or these old
they're
markets,
just committed to the middling pro.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is right. Everything they do is really helps the middling pro. And it's just not a real thing. More money in the top of the game is going to be good for the middle of the game.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on. High ratings. You know, congrats to everyone involved. Affirmation of what they had planned and what they wanted to do. I think it was double the rating of the seminal one, or, you know, more than double.
Yeah.
Whatever it was. You didn't have quarterbacks and Tiger Woods in that one either. So
they didn't even do a good job promoting it, though, either. That's kind of the amazing thing.
It was. I think they just, you know, relied on there not being a ton of sports out there and word of mouth a little bit. Twitter, I don't know. But yeah, it wasn't an onslaught like the first one, right? And They didn't have a lot of time. They had to whip it together in a month or something. So congrats to everyone involved on your high rating. Other news. You want to talk about the Slam doc, Tiger Woods Slam doc, or you want to push that off? Talk about
it
another time.
I don't know who watched it. I watched it last night and I was disappointed.
Why?
And this could be partially because I just watched The Last Dance.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tiger's on this in the same, you know, stratosphere of greatness of as
one
Michael
of the
Jordan.
Few. Like, and worldwide sort of recognized appeal, all that stuff. So.
And yeah. You know, Golf Channel hyped it up and like was really pumping it, and you know, I saw things like, oh, Last Dance is, you know, this is our, we're up next stuff. And it's just, and then I watched it. I just was like, I didn't learn anything. And there's so much there. And
you didn't like
just,
having,
it just gave me nothing.
Maybe I'm in this moment of just really during this pandemic diving into history of the game. So I thought it was easy and light historical thing to watch for me. I liked having Butch and Stevie involved. I think that was adding some value there. Peeling back a few things.
They didn't have any of the guys that like were trying to beat them. They didn't have Ernie Els. They didn't have VJ. They didn't have Phil talking. Like it was, I thought it was pretty like actually awful that they went after this, like the great, and they said it numerous times, like arguably the greatest athletic achievement of all time. And now they've burned it. They can't ever do it again.
You can't do a documentary on the 2000 US Open.
They can't do a Tiger Slam doc again. Why was it 45 minutes? You're talking about the greatest athletic achievement, arguably the greatest athletic achievement ever, and you give it 45 minutes, and it was just basically like if I just went on Wikipedia and skimmed what happened in each tournament. It was a joke.
I liked seeing Butch and Stevie. Some of the broadcasters attesting to it were fine. Tiger, of course, did not cooperate for it. I didn't have a strong opinion either way. I thought it was
really let down.
Okay. I thought it was good to, for my own purposes, as we, you know, part two of Ernie begins with 2000s, the year 2000.
Yeah, and I learned nothing. That's part of the reason I wanted to watch it.
There's nothing on Ernie. Yeah.
I didn't learn anything about anything. It was all just basically surface level stuff.
All right. So there's our comment.
I'm
not going to debate you on it.
I've actually very small experience putting together documentaries, but having watched a lot of 30 for 30s, almost every single one, and it was just a shit product.
So we'll put your opinion as a strong one than the strong camp about this.
The other thing too is like they tried to dress it up and make it seem cool with like big text and like good narrator.
They had Omar like, from The Wire, right?
Yeah,
narrating.
But it just wasn't
an Onyx.
It was it had all the bells and whistles, but none of the stuff that matters. It'd be like buying a Ferrari body, you know, everything Ferrari has, but then having like the engine of a Mazda Miata in it.
All right. So we have opinions on the slam dunk. I do not have an opinion either way. I'm 25 minutes in.
I mean, who's going to watch the Tiger slam
dunk? Well, here's the thing. We're talking about it 4 days after it happened. So we can't, I mean, it already aired.
Well, there's a reason I didn't hear anything about it either. Okay. That's the other thing. It's like, I was like curious. I wanted to watch it. And then I turned it on and I realized why nothing had blown up across my Twitter feed for 4 days.
We did get someone requesting us to do a spotlight on Butchie. So out of it, I noticed that. All right. Any other news you want to talk about before we get to Ruckit?
I got a hunch.
Oh, a hunch.
A hunch.
You're big on hunches. What's the hunch now?
I got a hunch that John Deere is not happening.
Whoa. An actual PGA Tour event on the schedule as part of this.
This is a hunch. This is
the first one with fans.
Don't read
into
it any more than just a hunch.
This is the first one with fans as of now, supposed to be, after the first four without fans.
I
can
guarantee you that if it does happen, the fans will not be happening.
And so this is
my great state I live in here in Illinois will not be having a fan event.
And so your hunch is that it won't happen at all? It may not happen at all?
It's my hunch that, I mean, we have the strictest restrictions of any state. Okay. And I don't think anything is going.
But your hunch is based off more than that, perhaps.
It's just my hunch.
All right, we'll see. Can't wait. Maybe further
and
reporting.
I think they'll probably fill that date with another event.
Yeah, that would make sense. I heard less hunchy, more rumory that the PGA, so all these are starting to open up to professional sports teams, right? You know, even New Jersey, all the, you know, sports teams are allowed back. I heard PGA is like, it seems like it's going to go ahead. California, at the start of this, didn't seem likely to maybe have it be ready in August, but it seems like that's going to be. I heard one that's like 90% probably without fans, which would make sense at this point. But there's still a slight odd chance they move it to Valhalla. Small chance. I think it's probably just going to be at Harding Park unless something
is
dramatically
Valhalla's
changes.
On the schedule again, right?
I assume so. They own it, right? PGA of America owns it.
I feel like they should. I mean, like the best aspect of the PGA at Harding Park, you know, like the PGA at Harding Park is not a story of we're going to a great golf course. It is a story of we're going to a golf course in a city.
Yeah. Is it a muni? What is it? TP?
Yeah.
It's a public course.
Yes. I don't know exactly that, but I think it's a muni. I think it's city run. But like that's the appeal of that championship. So
yeah.
To me, it would make a lot of sense. They're not going to have fans there.
Like I think it's probably going to be at Harding Park second weekend of August or first weekend and almost no fans. So, all right. Interesting hunch on the deer. Let's get to Ruckit, our spring evolving into summer of Ruckit.
I had him out yesterday.
Which one? Chippers?
The Chippers.
Whack-a-hack?
Yeah. Chippers. I actually played the Whack-a-hack game. Because it's supposed to be like bags.
Scoring.
Yeah. I had.
Who'd you play with? By yourself? Back and forth?
No, we had our friends that live in the town came over. It was all social distancing, you know. We sat outside, you know. Yeah. And I played Whack-a-hack.
Oh.
He stood one end. I stood the other. We made up our own scoring.
Okay.
I think there's official rules in the instructions, but I just made one. I don't know where my instructions are anymore.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you go. So, solid endorsement for the very specifics of the game. No, I agree. It is that again. My whole pitch on the Whack Hack is it's like cornhole, except you're also ideally sharpening a skill you will actually use somewhere beyond just your backyard.
Did you do any rucketing over the weekend?
I did a little soccer goal rucketing. We did whack-a-hacks. That's what we've been doing, that and the soccer goal the most, I would say. Occasionally, like once a week, I'll get out the big
golf
the
net.
Hack. Yeah, the hack net with the tri-turf mat. So, but yeah, the chipper nets. Our friends got one. I said
the chipper nets are like literally like they're addicting.
They are. They're so, again, some real dad shit. Like, I can put them up in 10 seconds.
Yeah.
They're just easy. The bags are buried in the back of my shed. They're so heavy. They're a pain in the ass to get out. You know, the bags are rotten now. They're getting, you know, they're going bad. We got to order new bags.
Like, you didn't take care of them, huh?
Yeah. Well, the whack hack is out, up, 10 seconds down, and 10 seconds.
I'll That's, remember honestly, that. Honestly, as a dad. You can't be trusted with nice things. That's what I take so away from this. Your bags all right, are rotting. So what's the, it's sad.
I think my wife is demanding we get more stuff for the backyard. And she's like, yeah, talk to Rucket. And maybe we'll go with the rebounder or something like that. So, but what's our promo code for Rucket?
SGS15.
15 gets you 15% off an order of $100 or more. Seems like our audience is dived in, I would
Dove
say.
In.
Dove in. a lot of positive word and use. We got one this week. Kid was chipping in his backyard. The big thing with your kids is, when do you decide to discard the foam balls and put real balls in play, or do you just keep using the foam balls? That's what our friends are debating.
I was
right
worried
now.
Yesterday with my buddy. He's not very good at golf.
Okay. Yeah.
And yeah. I was like, I don't know if we should be using real golf balls.
I mean, one kid refuses to not use anything but real balls now. And it's a problem because he takes great delight in hitting as hard as he can. And we don't live in an area with, you know, acres all over the place. So it's a big debate when you have kids.
I'm thinking about stretching it out. I've got a spot where I could put it, where I could hit like 50 yard wedges to it. And I'm
without
really
much danger, precarious. I mean, how dangerous would it get?
Not very dangerous. You know, I
see
your
wife getting pissed off.
I'm thinking about stretching it out one of these days.
Because you have no fence anymore. You got more room to roam.
This is all outside the fence. This has no bearing on the fence.
Okay. All right. So rucket.com, SGS15 is our promo code. Thank you guys for supporting us and them during this pandemic time. All right. What do we want to do now? Spotlight? Flashlights, I should say. Flashlight?
Flashlight.
All right.
You got a big flashlight.
I don't know if it's a big flashlight. It's got, yeah, double D batteries, things like that.
I've got like one of those mini flashlights, and it could have been a bigger flashlight, but I ran out of energy.
There you go. Worse for the wear. To be clear, this character is probably fully suitable for a blown out spotlight. We're just, you know, crunch for time. We don't, you know, trying to balance everything these days. So this is a Jumbo Ozaki. Masahi Jumbo Ozaki. My pronunciations are always challenged. My ability to pronounce things, and they will be especially challenged in this spotlight. So I apologize. A flashlight. I apologize in advance. But we'll do the legend of Jumbo Ozaki. He is the all-time wins leader on the Japan Golf Tour. Do you have any sense of how many times he won on the Japan Golf Tour?
82.
94. Ooh. Chase for 82. So why did you guess 82?
I don't know. That must have been subliminally in my head.
94 wins on the Japan Golf Tour. Do you know who had the next most and what amount, what number?
Like 34.
51 by Asayo Aoki.
Oh,
who
yeah.
They were kind of contemporaries.
Were they rivals? A
little bit. I got some intel from across the Pacific. People have been deep in the Japanese golf scene. Aoki was apparently like the genteel one. He's like, and people who, you know, your dad wanted, you should model yourself after Asai Aoki. Whereas Jumbo was more of a John Daly type. More,
no
definitely
way.
Flamboyant. Yeah, yeah. But Jumbo is definitely all time, the greatest Japan golf tour player of all time. 94 wins. They're both in the World Golf Hall of Fame, Aoki and Ozaki.
Well, deservingly too.
Yeah, of course. Jumbo didn't get in until 2011 though. Masashi, Jumbo, Ozaki. 94 Japan tour wins, 114 professional wins. It's a lot. That's a lot of wins. He rose to prominence.
Well, hold on. How many PGA tour wins? Because that's all
zero.
That matters.
Zero. And
so,
we'll get to that.
Zero wins. According
didn't play
to one,
much.
One organization, zero wins. He didn't do anything.
Never. I don't know if he ever even earned a single FedEx Cup point. Probably not. That started in 2007. But no PGA tour wins. His best win outside of the Japan tour is debatable. The 72 New Zealand PGA Championship was a big one. We'll talk a little bit about why he didn't go to the States that much, but he's had a T8 in the Masters, a T6 in the U.S. Open, 89, Oak Hill. Had a chance to beat Curtis Strange, bogeyed two holes, I think 12 and 14 at Oak Hill.
Yeah.
Kind of fell off.
He was down the stretch. He was right
there. And then T10 at the 1979 Open Championship. So in 49 majors, he had 10 top 25s, 3 top 10s. His top 10 at the Masters came in 1973, T8, with Tommy Aaron won it. So 73 was really when he burst onto the scene in Japan. He won 5 times on the Japan tour, rose to prominence in 73, had the T8 of the Masters, and he claimed the first of 12 money titles, order of merits, Japan tour.
It's pretty damn good.
That's not bad.
I might put him in the Hall of Fame right now.
Yeah, I would hope so. 12 order of merits? Put him in your Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
I would hope so. So he had 200 weeks inside the top 10, OWGR.
And he came out of the scene in 73. That's 13 years before the OWGR even started.
Yes, that's the thing. Like he was almost in his 50s, might have been in his 50s inside the top 10. He competed even to like a few years ago. He just keeps playing, even if he WD'd. I saw the one year he WD'd 9 out of 12 starts. He's like 69, though. He's like playing. He's really old to be playing on the Japan Golf Tour against like Ryo Ishikawa and players like that. So he won the Order of Merit 12 times, 200 weeks in the OWGR. What else did he do? He led the money title 5 years in a row from 94 to 98. He had six.
He was fifth in the world rankings when he was 49 years old.
Yeah. His peak in the OWGR was, 49. He got to fifth.
That's
kind of crazy.
Unreal.
It's insane. He'd be 73. He declined. 73 was that peak, his first peak, but he was right at the height of his powers on the Japan Golf Tour, like in his 40s. He dominated it for decades, but his peak in the OWGR was 49. Among his most prominent victories, he did 6 Japan PGA, 5 Japan Open. I think that might be an old article. Japan PGA won 8 times. He won the Dunlop Phoenix 6 times, the Taiyo Masters 3 times. So, like, those are fields, Dunlop, Taiyo Masters. Like, you had Fred Couples coming over. You had, like, real players playing in those events. Like, they're all real players. But, you had a stronger international field, and he would still blitz them. At 69, he played in 12 events, WD'd from 9. But I think he shot 62 when he was 68 years old on the Japan Golf Tour. So, he's, like, still competing. Think about, like, guy that on the Champions Tour right now, really, but it, Champions Tour eligible by 20 years, still trying to play. He's part of the best golf family ever, according to Brandel Chamblee. I listened to actually Sean Zock. I just found a podcast. He did a podcast on Jumbo with John Garrity on golf.com 3 or 4 years ago. And he had this Brandel calls him the greatest golfing family ever. Because, you know, Jet and Joe are his two younger brothers.
Jet Ozaki was on, did he play Japan Tour, and then did he play ever on European Tour?
He may have. Joe played Champions Tour in the States. Joe made a President's Cup himself, President's Cup team. And Joe, so Jumbo is number one on the Japan Golf Tour wins, all-time leader. And Joe is fourth. He won 32 times himself.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So two brothers in the top five. And then you had Jet, who was a very strong player in his own right.
Was their dad into golf, or how did they get into golf?
Jet won 15 times. So he's 16th on the all-time Japan Tour. So 15, 94, 32, and 15 wins. Probably the greatest golf family of all time.
Well, zero PGA Tour wins. So.
Zero. Again, six-time Dunlop, Tejo Masters. He's doing it at like all the premier events. Top tens at majors. But a lot of this was also, he was like this man of mystery for like an American audience, right? And I alluded to that whole John Daly thing. He teed it up way high. Like, so he was really early and teeing it up like 3-4 inches. And he would like swing way up on the ball. He just murdered the ball. Ben Crenshaw called him, he's like the early example of a power player, like just this athletic build. He's not huge for the nickname Jumbo. He's 6 feet, but he's very like well put together.
Thick
he's
boy.
Not, yeah, 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 preeminent thick boy. He's got like this mane of hair, like this mullet kind of thing. He had sideburns way down for a while. He's got just, he's got a thick looking build, thick head, squared off kind of haircut. And he's, yeah, it's Crenshaw, early example of a power golfer. He's the Arnold,
you know,
Palmer.
Hideki's pretty thick too.
Yeah, he's got a, yeah, he's thick in the middle.
I'm looking at the picture. They're both, they got that same kind of build.
Yeah, yeah. Beyond the wins, he's like the Arnold Palmer of Japan. That's like the cliche about him. He was just crazy popular, broad, just inspired the whole generation that came after him, the Shigeki Maruyamas, the Katayamas, obviously now with Matsuyama, and you know, just the whole, he supercharged the Japan Tour. Like the Japan Tour was a product of really the 70s, and just he made it more of a relevant tour, whether that be a stepping stone to something else, or if you wanted to stay and play only on the Japan Tour. He played like, he was known for like his crazy outfits, right? And John Garrity had a long profile on him. And it wasn't just like the design. So he had like all these stripes and triangles and geometric shapes, but apparently like he was big into materials. Like they had to be thousands of dollars worth of material, like velours, cashmeres, all these crazy materials. It was like really, I don't know, he would peacock around. So it wasn't just colors and designs, but the materials had to be like super primo. He had three songs reached the Japanese pop charts in 1980s. Got into music. He's on the Japan pop charts, three of them.
Man, what, a, just what worldly... other golfer right now do you think could get into music?
I don't know. I don't know. Very few.
Who would you bet on?
I don't know. That's a good question. Bryson? Is that just the default? I could see him try, not actually being successful, but attempting to think he was a pop star.
I feel like Kelly Kraft and Sam Ryder could get into like the jogger. They could have a band centered around joggers and, you know, they're...
So it was a lot more than just the success. It was the way he did it. Charisma... He was allegedly like super aggressive, just rip it, tee it up high, rip it, really aggressive. Obviously, did great success, had the family around him. He would travel with these massive entourages. when he'd come outside of Japan, he would usually bring like a sushi chef. So, and rent an enormous house. So his entourage felt at home.
He seems like he spent a lot of money.
Yes, a ton of money. But I'll get to, he probably made more money than anyone in the 90s, anyone on any tour. Because, you know, Japan, the 80s and 90s, Japan economy was booming and he was doing well. So he'd rent the biggest house, bring a sushi chef. There's this Brandel Chambly anecdote in an article. Brandel seems very fond of him. He called them Sinatra and Spikes. He was once playing with them, and they were waiting for a green to clear. And Jumbo puts his two fingers out, like doing the peace sign. But actually what it meant was he needed a cigarette. And somebody from his entourage immediately like appeared out of nowhere and put a cigarette in between his fingers. Standing on the tee, doing the peace sign. Guy appears out of the ether to put a cigarette between his fingers. So that's a little bit of the character. We'll get into now some of the source material. I talked to, a friend from the, a friend who's deep in the Japanese golf scene, deep in golf history, but certainly specific to Japanese golf history. So some of this is I don't know if it's reporting, but beyond just secondary sources. This person who chose to remain anonymous suspects in the early 90s he was the richest golfer in the world, had to be the richest golfer in the world, just given the cash, given the Japanese economy, given the way he won. And there's a few articles later just about Brian. There was a Brian Watts article about the guy is like the easiest money. These purses are bigger than the PGA Tour. And Jumbo was cleaning up.
Brian Watts, the guy that purposely hit his ball.
Yes, yes. Yes. He would decline. He declined a special invitation to play in the Masters because he was allegedly, you know, according to this source, he had a habit of hanging out with the wrong people in Tokyo. Yakuza members, or Yakuza, which is the organized crime in Japan. And he was a great player, but, you know, these associations with the mob, you know, started to leak out in the press. But not in the U.S., but more in Japan. He was, you know, maybe friends with or possibly even working with the Yakuza. So he thought it would become a sideshow or distraction. And, you know, if he'd won or been in contention, it would just blow up in Japan. So he didn't even go to the Masters, allegedly, because of that. But here's the contrarian.
He was just putting his money to work on the street.
Here's the contrarian take from our source from overseas. About why maybe he became tied up with them. The economy in Japan in the 80s, 90s was a complete bubble, and golf is wildly popular, and you couldn't join a club there for less than like US equivalent of $250,000. This is the 80s or 90s.
That's insane.
So the mafia types control these local governments, and they're able to get golf courses approved because they're crooks. So the Japanese Yakuza really starts to take over like entire portions of the golf business, golf world. They're getting these clubs built. There's like a legendary tale of a top Yakuza member offering $3.5 million to join one, a top tier club, a Koganai. So Ozaki is pretty much in the prime of his career during this time. And so it was like hard to navigate the Japanese golf world without like having to deal with the mafia in some way. You know, the old school courses like Hirono, like they didn't get tied up in this. This was all this like new age courses, $250,000 to join, all this stuff. But it was really hard for Jumbo to probably navigate the golf world at this time without touching some tentacles of the mob. And that was like the contrarian take. Not necessarily that he was like, you know, boys with everybody in the organized crime family, but. We'll get into a little bit, maybe the popular take as opposed to the contrarian take. More from our source overseas. Much of the fact is that he never, ever won on the PGA Tour, quote, but that is a lot of bullshit. I don't think he really ever cared. And because he was like the most popular player on one of the richest tours in the world.
Yeah.
He's just making an absolute killing. People who complain that he never really played on the tour, who cares? No one on the PGA Tour made more money than Jumbo in the 80s and 90s. What else? He's truly, he's one of the greats of his generation. I'm certain that 100% sure if he cared at all about the PGA Tour, he played there and won a lot, but he just didn't care. He probably made more money than Norman doing pop songs and being a celebrity in Japan. So that's it. That's from someone deep in Japan golf. Again, the Aoki point. He's the complete opposite of Ozaki. He's a gentleman. He's the one, you know, people, your dad wanted him to.
He wasn't tied up with the Yakuza.
Well, this is a quote from our source. He's probably never even had a parking ticket, let alone been associated with the Yakuza. Jumbo, not so much. Okay, let's move on. Let's move on here. So this is a John Garrity profile. This is the only real American writing on Ozaki in the prime of his career. It's actually towards the end of his career. It was a 1998 profile before the 98 Masters. Jumbo's cigarette touches his lips when he exhales. Smoke plumes past his bold sideburns and unblinking eyes. Jumbo's caddy stands by holding a leather pouch of sand. He will douse the cigarette when Jumbo is ready. Jumbo's tight lip smile suggests boredom or menace. Here in Japan, guy has a pouch of sand. That's just an ashtray for him. Here in Japan, Jumbo is huge. He is the rising sun on the white flag. His feet leave permanent footprints. His muttered jokes bring smiles to spectators 400 yards away as if transmitted over the gallery ropes. He is Ichiban, number one, here in Japan. Just Arnold Palmer of Japan. Massive, massive success. And I really couldn't find a ton of American writing on him. Garrity, of course, he was the one who did the VJ stuff, right? When we profiled VJ, yeah. He went to Fiji. Like, so he must have been really one of the premier, you know, reporting on international players. And the Garrity profile brings to light some of the cheating allegations. Most of it was put forth by Norman, who would occasionally dabble with, you know, Australasia events. Norman alleged that Jumbo would fluff his lie. A Patrick Reed type thing. Put his driver down or put his three wood down in the rough behind the ball and fluff his lie. He did it on multiple occasions. He accused him of doing that. But like the Japanese press allegedly like would treat it. I don't know. They would give it sort of soft treatment. Our source in Japan said it was overblown a little bit. Like there's just too much made of the cheating allegations. Americans would sneer at his world ranking, which at the time of this Garrity article, he was 10th at 51 years old. He was 10th in the world. And his reluctance to play much outside of Asia. Visitors to Japan eat up rumors that he is, you know, a member, a fellow traveler of the Yakuza. So just this man of mystery. I should add, before he became a golfer, he was a star pitcher. Rising star pitcher and just gave it up. He got into golf because his baseball coach was into golf. He was like obsessed with golf and he got Jumbo into golf.
Unbelievable.
He was star pitcher for like a spring national champion, which, you know, according to Garrity in Japan bestows status comparable to that of a quarterback of the U.S. national champion on a college football team. Pretty good.
Really good.
So, I mean, it's like, I don't know, Tua Tagovailoa, all of a sudden taking up golf, kind of thing,
and becoming the best player in the country.
Yeah, ever. So he was introduced to golf by his manager, and the team he signed with in 1967. Playing baseball in 67 and 73 as a five win season on Japan Tour and gets a top 10 of the major 6 years later. Apparently, he had like a two personalities. So Masashi was like this more reserved Japanese, like really like devote to like Japanese sort of reticence, culture, much more inward and not showy or flashy. Whereas Jumbo is like, I know that I need to put on a show and that's my personality. I'm going to wear the loud clothes, smoke cigarettes nonstop, try to tell jokes, you know, and interact with the gallery. Jumbo emerged 30 years ago when he was teaching himself the game, and it burst full-blown onto the scene when he gave up baseball at age 22. From the beginning, I wanted to look good, wear good clothes, and be in the spotlight. When he won the Dunlop in 96, beating the cream of Asian golfers by a score, it was his 100th pro victory, and it marked his third straight title. And, you know, he took, like, great pains to celebrate. He won 100 pro events. Like, this is, like, took great pains to celebrate it. And Tom Watson attested to this. He goes, anytime you win 100 tournaments, you can flat play. So that was sort of the debate. Like, we never see him. How can he be 10th in the world? He won, you know, when he could have been playing the Champions Tour, he won 5 more Japanese tour events, won by 12 shots. 12 shots. So it just, like, year to year, constant dominance.
Domination.
Yeah. By the way, when he travels, the entourage is called the Koban. At the Masters, he rents, like, one of the largest houses in Augusta, flies in the sushi chef from New York. The golfers dress like him. There's just so much detail. Let's go specific, couple of different specific tentacles.
Did you see this driver article?
Yeah, I've got a lot on the driver.
Yeah.
Got a lot on the driver. There's some... You want to talk about it?
I just found it. I was just rummaging around the internet.
Norman was the big antagonist of his cheating, fluffing lies. But O'Meara's caddy, I think his name was Higginbotham, Jerry Higginbotham, said he'd heard like he was playing Chinese checkers when he marks his ball, was the quote he told Garrity. But then Higginbotham, like, caddied against him or in an event, is like, he's unbelievable. Unbelievable talent. I didn't see any cheating. So he, like, relayed the rumors of cheating, played with them, that came back to Garrity. He's like, he's an unbelievable talent. I didn't notice anything untoward, especially with marking Chinese checkers, marking his ball. But Norman was pissed off at him. The other thing, allegation beyond cheating, was that he played with non-conforming equipment. All the Americans were convinced he was playing a hot ball and a hot driver. The ball, though, he was just ahead of everybody. He's playing a two-piece solid core ball and teeing it way up, whereas like guys that eventually got into that, apparently it was a ball that was just, like, you could get for cheap. It was out there. It was a Bridgestone ball.
Precept, yeah, Bridgestone, right. Yeah.
So it was just like a two-piece solid core ball that, you know, they didn't have, I don't think it had the urethane cover yet. Like, it probably didn't spin a ton around the green, but he would just hammer it, no spin, and crushed it. That would become the ball. So these guys all thought it was a hot ball, and eventually it would become the technology that they all started using. He was just a little ahead of people. What else? At the 2000 Masters, so this is that Garrity had a big article on the 2000 Masters, the ball changing, which I would recommend. We're not going to get into ball debates now. This would become 3 hours long. But 59 out of 95 players used wound golf balls at the 2000 Masters. And then, you know, the next year, 01, 24 of the top 25, including the winners, played solid core balls.
James,
do you know
really
who the one holdout was when they finished in the top 25 playing a wound ball?
Mac O'Grady.
Kirk Triplett, the Bucket Boy.
The Bucket Boy.
2001 Masters.
Was trying to hold on to his wounder.
Only 4 players in the field used it.
He might have won that year if he had been using solid core.
Triplett. So 59 in 2000, only 4 used in 2001. It was a really good diversion into the ball that I would recommend. And this was where, like, urethane comes in, moldable material. It, like, you know, adds to the soft feel, a bit of grab on finesse shots. There's disagreement who was the first to perfect the urethane process, but Nike Bridgestone won the rush to the marketplace. And this is the Nike guys talking about it. You title this being full of shit in this Garrity article. It's a fun dive into the change in the ball technology, 2001 article. But in there, he goes, this has been going on in Asia forever. Jumbo Ozaki wowed visiting Westerners with his booming tee shot. Since Ozaki was about as tall as a file cabinet and pushing 50, the visitors reached the obvious conclusion he was cheating. Rumors spread that Ozaki was playing a hot ball, an illegal prototype manufactured for him by the engineers at Bridgestone. When you think about it, this was a Callaway rep. Jumbo was the first who teed it up 3.5 to 4 inches and then launched it at 12 or 13 degrees with little spin. He was playing a solid core ball made by Bridgestone, and those balls were and are very good. So competitors saying it. But late 90s, they're like, this guy's playing
cheating.
A hot ball.
Yeah.
Also, there are allegations about his driver. He had a Bridgestone driver. I think it became like the J driver.
The
his
J,
own
yeah,
driver.
The J.
And we found this in the 1990 Masters when Nicholas, with on our Faldo recap, but Nicholas played it, Floyd played it. They were like, they couldn't believe this driver. And allegedly, Nicholas, like he went to Japan and Ozaki was like hammering it by him.
Yeah.
Like 50 yards.
So on one par five, Nicholas recalled, I hit a good drive, a 2-iron and a pitching wedge to the green. Jumbo reached it with a driver and an 8-iron. I finally turned to him and said, what are you using?
The J driver. Allegedly, Nicholas...
He was out hitting the Golden Bear by 90 yards.
Nicholas allegedly, I think Garrity added this, took that back to McGregor, who was his...
Yeah. There's a New York Times article that talks about this.
And McGregor like stripped it down and found that it was like just a metal version of Jack's old McGregor wood, allegedly. It was very similar to but just a metal version of it. And so Jack like immediately took a liking to it and was able to hit it well. But Bridgestone J got all the rage. And Floyd had it 90. Jumbo gave it to Nicholas as a gift. It became this other like very Ozaki specific, you know, equipment. I don't know if it's controversy, but phenomenon.
Here's Jack. I don't hit it any straighter than I do with my old driver, but it penetrates the wind better. And when it hits on hard ground, it seems to roll and roll. I don't know what the shaft is. It just has an X on it.
Is that what Jack said?
Yeah.
Kind of unbelievable. So that was the big thing at the 90 Masters. You know, allegedly at the PGA, I read an article of PGA National, his newest weapon, the graphite driver, he filched from Japan's Jumbo, was like neutralized at PGA National. It's just like this became a phenomenon for Jack even, and Ray Floyd when he was contending at the 90 Masters. All right, let's get back to a little bit of the Garrity stuff. Press treatment, like they, you know... Jumbo's response so he got a little bit of criticism for the Yakuza stuff. His response was the sound of one hand clapping. Never gave interviews, basically. Would do the press conferences. If you wanted to talk to him, like you had to send letters to Bridgestone or an equipment company or his manager. Like he just, and you just take a few days and you'd be like, decline. Apparently, Garrity eventually got him, but only for like a few questions. You know, and you just get, you know, almost 9 times out of 10, you get denied and it takes like weeks and weeks to ever get anything outside of his press conference. Interests, he collected cars, played guitar, talked about those pop hits. He's, according to Garrity, he's the opposite of Aoki, who just only knows golf. Here's Ozaki. Aoki-san looks at golf as his hobby and his work. I envy him in a way, but I know I cannot do that. I need to get away. And he just smokes. He crushes his cigarette in his ashtray, lights another. I have used up a lot of time and money on hobbies. So when Garrity was there, he had moved on from cars and singing to bonsai trees, like $10,000 bonsais, into grooming these trees and wine, huge into wine. So just constant hobbies, spending a ton of money. On staying in Japan, he said, hold on, I lost it. He's like, I've seen the American tour, the enthusiasm in the galleries and the level of play. It's too bad I wasn't born there so I could feel that same fire in me. The Japanese golf world needs me, though. Needs. He smiles indulgently. No, Japan does need Jumbo. His speed tribe melding of Elvis, James Dean, and Liberace with the golf peacock of Doug Sanders thrown in. The tournament site is a stage for me. I want to be the sort of person the fans want me to be. So totally playing up to that crowd and didn't have like knew he wouldn't have that appeal necessarily in America, so he just didn't bother going over there. What else do we have here? So there were all those questions of why he can't win outside Japan. His detractors say it's because he can't stretch the rules outside of Asia. Others point out that Ozaki has never made a concerted assault at the majors. More intriguing theory, and one that mirrors a common complaint of many Japanese women about their husbands, is offered by Ayako Akimoto, the Japanese pro who won 17 tournaments in an LPGA tour. This is fantastic. So she said, sorry, I lost my place. She says, Ozaki and the other men can't win abroad because they're the victims of the doting mother syndrome prevalent in Japan. That is, they're so spoiled they can't function on their own, or as she puts it, they can't make it without their cup noodles.
Unbelievable.
Just the LPGA Japanese star going right at them. They're softies. They can't win outside of Japan. They need to be doted on by their, you know, wives or their moms. And Ozaki has his non-explanation. When I get in that atmosphere, I don't get the urge to win as strongly, which seems like kind of a punt.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, he pushed at the 73 Masters. Dan Jenkins wrote that up. He's like, we don't know anything about this. And Chichi Rodriguez, it would be a good thing for a foreigner to win the Masters. So 73, you know, we don't get the British invasion yet. It would be good for human relations, good for England, for Osterhaus, who was in contention, Japan for Ozaki, but better for Puerto Rico and Chichi. So 73 Masters is maybe his first big intro outside of Japan. He got really into teaching. He had just this school of players. So he's allegedly shy. You know, he's flamboyant on the course, but sort of shy when talking. But he's not a recluse, according to Garrity. In his backyard, by his practice facility, he had an enormous backyard. He has built a motel-style housing for members of his gundan, or the 20 or so golf apprentices who look to him for instruction and career guidance. It is commonplace, insiders say, for Ozaki's wife to cook dinner for 30. So he's got these 20 like apprentices living in a motel in his backyard. Every January, the gundan moves to the tropical Okinawa or Kyushu for Jumbo's spring camp, a sort of grapefruit league for golfers. There, Jumbo leads calisthenics and prepares his charges, such as the effervescent Shigeki Maruyama, this is 1998, who rode the leaderboard for much of last year's PGA championship. He prepares them for the rigors of international golf. The irony, of course, is that Jumbo has chosen the most parochial of career paths. So he never went outside Japan, but he's allegedly kind of coaching and building and planning, you know, housing all these younger charges to play international golf.
Sounds like the KJ Choi school. He's got
building like a motel.
I love the motel. That's unbelievable. What do you think the rooms are like in the motel?
I don't know. Probably pretty nice. He's a man of means and very, you know, he spares no expense. What other like international showing? 96 President's Cup. He finally played. He passed before, though. In 94.
How did he do in the one President's Cup?
I forgot to look that up. He played with Singh, and they beat Freddie in Love, 96. So that was couples in Love. You know, they were the World Cup superstars.
Mm-hmm.
They went paired with Singh. Ozaki and Singh beat him. But I guess Norman, the President's Cup, we should do a deep dive on President's Cup one day. The origins of it. In 1994, Norman, the world's number one player then, he was sidelined by a virus, and Ernie and Jumbo just turned it down, straight up turned it down, qualified for the Pres Cup, said no. Over the next 2 years, Norman and his mates applied considerable pressure to bring Els and Ozaki into the fold. In fact, last month, this is a Shipnook article, 96. Last month at the PGA Championship at Valhalla, the Shark jaywalked across two fairways to recruit Ozaki. Keep pressuring him.
And he didn't like him.
No. So they had reconciled a little bit. Norman just wanted to play with them, you know, needed him on the President's Cup. And he did play at 96. They beat couples in Love. In 1998, Joe Ozaki played. And that was when the Internationals smoked him. And they kind of like, how did this happen? U.S. had 5 of the top 10 players in the world, while the international had no bads that included Paraguayan Carlos Franco, Frank Nabolo, another Kiwi named Greg Turner, and Jumbo Ozaki's kid brother, Joe. And they lost, got smoked. Major championships, we'll talk about that real quick. 89 U.S. Open, Oak Hill. Our source in Japan said that was like the heartbreaker. The real close one, like Matsuyama, Quail Hollow, Tommy Nakajima, Old Course. This was like, he was pushing Curtis Strange. He was maybe Strange's biggest threat until he bogeyed.
I watched back that back nine. He was in there late.
He started, he hit 2 really bad drives on 14 and 16 and ended it. 90 Masters, he was involved because everybody was using his equipment. 1995 Shinnecock plays with Norman, final group on Saturday. This was Pavin won Sunday, but he was in the final group on Saturday. And he got vaporized, got completely nuked. I think he shot a 45 on the back nine, shot 80 overall. He climbed within a stroke of the lead and dropped entirely off the leaderboard with the backside 45. He hit he double bogeyed 10, which is, the hilly one, up and down par 4. And doubled 16, which is a par 5. Probably not going to win there with the double there. He finished with an 80. So that was like a close-ish call playing in the last group.
The finish doesn't represent where he
on
was.
On the weekend? Yeah. He allegedly was arguing for a friendly ruling from an anthill, which he argued was a burrowing animal. But our guy, Trey Holland, from the urologist who gave Ernie the friendly drop, wouldn't give it to Jumbo the following year from an anthill. Here's a 1994 Brian Watts. This is what I wanted to say. The competition, Watts admits, on the Japan Golf Tour is inferior, but the purses are not. Each of the 38 JPGA events offers between $600,000 and $2 million. Having won 5 times this year, Watts has seized $1.28 million of that loot, which makes him second to Jumbo, who's already almost at $1.88 million. He's tops on that tour and led the entire world in earnings. So 1994, he's made almost $2 million. It's welcome to the land of the rising sum. Only 6 players in the world have earned more money in official events than Brian Watts in 94. This is the same player 4 times failed to make it out of Q school. The money's so much easier to make in, you can make a ton of it. And that's like a lot of that's due to Jumbo, right? The economy's booming. Jumbo's this leader. Why would he ever leave? That was like a major part of it. He was making so much money. Granted, there was prestige in the Masters. He turned it down. He turned down the Masters more than once. But, he was living it up in Japan. There was no real reason to take off. And that led to critiques. This guy's 5th in the world. This guy's 10th in the world. He's allegedly cheating.
We see that still now, like with the international players.
There is a little bit, right? So, and I don't know. I think he was a real perfectionist. He was a flamboyant character, obviously had ties to allegedly the Yakuza. One more thing, because Garrity had tried to firm it up with that. Bridgestone, he bailed on Bridgestone for this random sort of, it was unclear that this company called World One Equipment. Since journalists have shown little interest in following up on the Yakuza, Ozaki punishes Yamayori by refusing to talk to its reporters. It's still a delicate subject, says a Yamayori business writer. It's an outlet. You don't ask whose money is behind Jumbo or World One. Bridgestone would like to know too. The Japanese golf equipment dominates its home market thanks largely to its long relationship with Ozaki. But last November, Jumbo signed an equipment deal with little-known World One, an entertainment company that started 10 years ago as a pipsqueak outfit renting karaoke machines. This company was renting karaoke machines. They gave Ozaki, estimated to be as high as $200 million over 5 years or no lower than $20 million, which is a big gap, $20 to $200 million. But this company...
pretty fishy.
So it invited speculation. The deal was designed to, funnel cash to the golfer. Bridgestone was left with just the ball. So he kept playing the ball. All right, so that's it. Made a ton of money at home being the Arnold Palmer, you know, endorsements, winning, being this personality. Was much more reserved off the course, kind of at home. He was Masashi on the course. He was Jumbo. Smoked nonstop. Total character. Legend of golf. Is he in your Hall of Fame?
There's a Japan Times article that says he's bankrupt.
That's the other thing. He allegedly chased tons of real estate. Bad real estate. And apparently that World One deal was maybe to funnel cash to him via untoward sources. So
I think he is. He won 115 times. 114 times. How do you win 114 times and not be in it?
I think it's hard. Like, I just don't think it wasn't because he couldn't make it. He just doesn't seem like he was interested or needed to. Granted, he could have gone to more majors. His major record is underwhelming. He competed. The thing I got was when he competed against those guys, you have Crenshaw talking about it, Hale Irwin talking about it, you know, Omira's Looper attests to it, Norman eventually came around. Like, they're like, this guy is an unbelievable world-class talent. They couldn't believe how far he was hitting the ball and just really his overall talent.
He was ahead of his times, too.
With the solid core?
Yeah.
So, all right. Pop singer, legendary, Hall of Famer. And in fact, in the World Golf Hall of Fame. That's our flashlight on Jumbo. Approaching spotlight territory there. Except just me narrating it.
All right. Jumbo.
Jumbo. We're going to push yours to another time. Does that make sense?
That's fine. That's fine. The world will have to wait for Chris Patton.
Chris Patton amateur win. The guy who Rick Riley destroyed in that article. All right. Everyone enjoy your Wednesdays. We will be back Friday with Ernie Els. Get deep into Ernie Els. The year 2000 onward, his last two majors. And enjoy your Wednesdays. We'll be back.